single again, but not for long. I decided to start dating again as a form of distraction and subscribe to the internet dating site I'd used before. Once again, I got to meet a number of nice women, but never really got into it. Debbie just wouldn't leave me alone. Every day I received dozens of SMS messages, emails, and telephone calls. I tried to ignore her, not to respond. I really felt for her, as she was hurting and struggling to accept that it was over. Eventually, I set up an automatic forwarding rule on my email to immediately forward any email she sent me to her mother and Eliza, her psychologist. I thought that might help, but it didn't. All that happened was she was now filling three email boxes instead of one. She kept coming to my house and ringing the bell. Finally, I decided to issue an instruction to the guards at the security gate not to let her through the boom. I gave them a photograph of her and her car's registration number. That should keep her away, or so I thought. Later, in March, after many different dates, I met someone else who was quite special. But it was the way we met that was amazing. I had met another lady by the name of Charisse at a lunch date on a Wednesday. It was pleasant, and we seemed to get on quite well. The following day, she phoned me to ask if I wanted to accompany her to her friend's birthday party on Saturday evening. I had no plan, so I agreed. We agreed to meet at her friend's house at 5 o'clock, but she asked me to call her when I arrived so that she could make an entrance with me. On Saturday afternoon, while I was watching rugby on television, Shayna asked me if I was going out that evening. I'd been going out quite often of late, so she was not surprised to hear that I was going out on a date. I really didn't feel like going out, but as I'd made a commitment, I had to honour it. I was indifferent about going to the party, as I barely knew Charisse and certainly didn't know anyone else who'd be there. I can be very sociable, but in an environment where I know everyone. Meeting new people and making small talk was something I didn't enjoy, so reluctantly and unenthusiastically, I finally got dressed and left for the party. I phoned Charisse when I arrived, and she met me outside and walked me in. It was still early, so there weren't too many people, so I was introduced to everyone present, including Mirinda, who was hosting the party. The small talk began. Charisse had been drinking wine when I arrived and asked me to top up her glass. I duly obliged, and before I knew it, she was ready for another glass. No problem. But something in the back of my mind niggled, as previous experiences of women drinking too much white wine had not been pleasant. If she was drinking something else, it would never have crossed my mind. But white wine somehow rang an alarm bell. I had formed a theory that a female who overindulges on white wine or white spirits is very likely to become difficult, emotional, and possibly even physically aggressive. After an hour or two, I decided that Charisse was definitely not for me. She was getting louder and more amorous, calling me darling and love. This scared me, as I barely knew her, and she definitely did not know me. I began to mingle. Yes, me. Like a social butterfly, meeting people, making small talk, but more importantly, distancing myself from Charisse. It must have been about 7:30 when this woman made an appearance. I noticed her immediately, and when she looked in my direction, our eyes locked. I smiled at her, she smiled back. It was the most amazing instant of recognizing and knowing a complete stranger. I couldn't stop looking at her while trying to establish if she was with someone. I was introduced to her. Her name was Roxy. It appeared she was with a guy by the name of David, as she spent a lot of time with him. A little later, a few people started dancing, and I decided to join in. I went and asked David if he'd mind if I asked his girlfriend to dance. No problem. And she wasn't his girlfriend. Great. She was single. As it turned out, I was the only male dancing. So I didn't get to dance with her as such, but ended up with a group of about six women. As the night progressed, Charisse got absolutely trashed and became excessively loud. I noticed that she was beginning to offend people, so I took her aside and suggested we leave. She wasn't keen, but she was way past making rational decisions. I told her I'd give her a lift home, as she was in no state to drive. I had no idea where she lived, but offered to drive her home, fetch her the next morning, and drive her back to Marinda's house to fetch her car. She became difficult, reluctant to leave, but Marinda came outside and asked her to leave and let me take her home. She went to retrieve her handbag, and next thing, she'd managed to get into her own car. There was no way she could drive, so I removed her keys from the ignition, and after much persuasion, I finally managed to get her out of the car and into mine. My car was parked on the pavement, perpendicular to the road where other cars were parked. As I began to reverse, she started screaming and shouting at me that I had turned her friends against her and it was all my fault. I was taken by surprise, so much so that I took my eyes off my rearview mirror and dinged the car parked behind me, not seriously, but noticeably. I moved forward as she decided to jump out of the car and go back to the party. I remember saying out loud, "Why me, Lord?" It was like deja vu, my white wine theory proven again with someone I barely knew, had spent little time with, and here I was suffering the consequences again. I parked my car and checked the damage. My car had a few minor scratches on the bumper, while the other vehicle, a 3 Series BMW, had a slight dent above the right rear wheel arch. There were some teenage kids outside in the street who had witnessed everything. One of the kids was Marinda's daughter, who said I should ignore Charisse and leave her, as she was always getting out of hand. Why didn't they tell me this when I arrived? As much as I now wanted to leave, I couldn't. I had to find the owner of the vehicle and let him know, or her know, what had happened. As I went back to the driveway, I heard screaming and shouting as Charisse came outside in tears. Some woman had apparently had enough of Charisse's antics and had given her a smack that left her with a slight cut above her eye. Marinda had by now also had enough, so she took Charisse, bundled her into her car, and told her to leave, which she did. I was in a state of bewilderment. What had I done to deserve this? I managed to find the owner of the BMW and explained what had happened. I gave him my business card so we could sort out the damages. I said my goodbyes, but Marinda and her boyfriend were not about to let me leave. They had taken a liking to me and insisted I stay a little longer. While I was sitting there chatting to them and Roxy, who had joined us, I started receiving a number of abusive, threatening SMSs from Charisse, blaming me for the events of the evening. Everyone sitting there found the SMSs amusing, but I was wondering how I managed to find these women. A couple of hours later, it was time to go. Roxy had also had too much to drink, and it was unwise for her to drive home. I said I'd give her a lift, either to her place or mine, and we could come back in the morning to fetch her car. I decided we'd go to my place, and she said it was okay. Driving to my house, which was only 10 minutes away, we chatted, and I had this strange feeling that we knew each other. Everything seemed comfortable and natural, as if we were returning home as a long-established couple. She said she needed to leave early as she had to get to the airport to fetch her boyfriend, who was flying back from Dubai. This was a curveball, to say the least. This was not good news. When we got home, I suggested that she use the spare room or my room, but all she asked for was a T-shirt and some shorts. She went to the bathroom and changed, then got into my bed. I changed and got into bed as well. We continued chatting about all sorts of things, and I instinctively knew that we had a karmic connection. It was eerie, as I could almost anticipate what she'd say next. I mentioned this, and she said that it was also strange for her because she felt so comfortable with me. She said she would never have left with someone she didn't know, but she'd felt okay with me. After a while, she said she was tired and needed to sleep, as she had to get to the airport in a few hours. I turned to her and said, "You do know that when you fetch him, you're going to take him back to his house and break up with him because you and I are going to be together." I'm not sure what prompted me to say this, but I just did. She looked at me and was silent for a moment. "Yes, I know that." That was it. We were about to start a relationship. We fell asleep almost immediately, and when the alarm went off a couple of hours later, I woke her and we left to fetch her car. I decided I needed to check if she remembered what we had discussed a few hours earlier. To my relief, she remembered and said she'd call me later. Perhaps it was easy for her to say that she was going to break up with him, but it was quite another thing to actually do it. Even more so when she'd been quite comfortable in the relationship up until a couple of hours earlier, when the thought of breaking up had never even crossed her mind. Time would tell. As the hours passed, I began to think that she changed her mind. Eventually, later that afternoon, I received an SMS from her to say that she'd broken up with him and was on her way. We agreed to meet for a drink, and that was the start of a new relationship. In early April, Debbie had started her quest to get my ticket to the Robbie Williams concert due on the 17th of April 2006. Many months before, she'd managed to get through to CompuTicket the day the tickets went on sale. There was a ticket frenzy that day. I'd tried to book through the internet, but the site had crashed. I'd also tried to phone, but with no success. Somehow, that afternoon, Debbie managed to get through and she booked. She wanted two tickets for her mom and aunt, and I wanted eight in total, two of which were obviously for Debbie and me, the balance for friends. Debbie used my credit card to pay for the tickets. After she moved out in January, she asked me if she could buy her ticket from me, to which I agreed. Now that things were definitely over, she started hounding me for my ticket, as there were reserved seats and she didn't want to sit next to me. I told her that I was not prepared to give her my ticket, as I wanted to see the concert. My friends, whom, interestingly enough, I had met through Debbie a couple of years earlier, were not keen to go to the concert if she was going to be there, as they weren't particularly fond of her. By this time, Debbie had found out that I'd met someone else, so this obviously angered her. Eventually, after lots of abusive emails and calls, she sent me an email saying she had managed to swap her ticket with someone else, so she wouldn't have to see me. On the morning of Wednesday, the 7th of April, 2006, after I left gym, I saw that Debbie had sent me a couple of SMSs demanding that I give her my Robbie Williams ticket and return all the gifts she had given me for Christmas and my birthday. I responded via SMS to say no to her demands. Over the years, I had spent a fortune on her for presents, paying off her debts, holidays, paying towards the deposit on her new car, engagement ring, clothing, jewelry, etc. To me, it was a matter of principle, as you don't take back birthday or Christmas gifts. She phoned me and I told her politely that I wasn't prepared to do this, said goodbye and ended the call. She kept on phoning, so I just ignored the calls, all 20-odd of them. Shortly after I got home, I heard the gate bell ring, and as I looked up out of my study, I saw her yellow Renault at the gate. I wondered how she'd managed to get through the security boom. I walked outside, and she started screaming and shouting at me to give her her Robbie Williams ticket. She already had hers. She was referring to mine, which she wanted as well. And the present she'd bought me. I said no, and that she should leave. As I turned to walk away, she kept on ringing the gate bell and screaming. She was shouting to the neighbours that I was a bastard who broke women's hearts, that I was a liar, a cheat, and goodness knows what else. All the time, Brett and Shana were watching the proceedings, as they were at home studying for their exams. I went back to the gate and pleaded with her to leave, otherwise I'd call the security. But she wouldn't hear of it. She then pressed her hooter and held it down, making an interminable noise. I tried to call Eliza, her psychologist, but she didn't answer, so I left a message for her. I managed to get hold of her mother, as she happened to be at home recovering from surgery. I told her what was happening and asked her to call Debbie and talk some sense into her. She could hear Debbie screaming and shouting in the background and said she would try. Debbie wasn't letting up, so I called the security company, but they were so disorganized that I decided to go inside and press the panic button. This set off the house alarm, which Debbie could obviously hear. I suggested she leave before the guards arrived. She threw her mobile phone over the gate towards me and got into her car. I picked it up and tossed it through the diagonal slits of the gate onto the grass next to her car, but she ignored it and reversed out of the driveway. She had gone back about 10 meters, and assuming she was about to leave, I turned my back to the gate. The next thing I heard was his high-pitched engine revving and the squeal of tires as she hurtled straight at the gate, knocking it clean off its hinges towards me. I had to backpedal very quickly in order for the gate not to hit me. She slammed the car into reverse, showed me her middle finger, and drove off. To put this in perspective, the gate is made of solid steel. It takes at least 5 men to lift it. It took some force to knock it off its rails and move it more than 2 meters into my yard. The security guards arrived shortly afterwards, and they in turn called the police, who arrived in due course. In the pandemonium, I managed to call the company which serviced the electric gate, and they rushed out to help, as we were now prisoners in our own home because the gate was too heavy to move. I decided to take photographs. I wanted her to pay for the damage, and I wanted to get a restraining order against her, as she'd really lost her mind. The police arrived, and I opened a case of malicious damage to property against her. I was going to use this as the basis for a restraining order. The strange thing was that I wasn't angry with her. I felt sorry for her. She was letting her life slide further and further out of control. It made me realize that one of my objectives for the past 2 years was to become non-judgmental. At least I was able to achieve this and live it. Eliza called me later and explained what had happened. She was really disappointed and told me she was no longer seeing Debbie. Apparently, Debbie had cancelled several appointments, saying she needed her medical aid cover to fund Callum's counselling sessions with a child psychologist. Eliza had told her that it was critical for her to keep on with the sessions and even offered to treat Debbie for free. Perhaps it is more accurate to say that Eliza was probably getting close to the real issues which caused her flight response. It took the whole day to get the gate straightened and upright, and another day to replace the gate motor that had been ripped apart. The total cost? A little over 6,700 rand. Later that afternoon, Debbie arrived with a friend to collect her mobile phone. I silently handed the phone to her friend and went back inside. The following morning, I went to the Randburg Magistrates' Courts to begin the process of obtaining a restraining order against her. The queue was horrendously long, and after 2 hours I'd made no progress. As I had a luncheon appointment with some former colleagues, I decided to leave and come back on the Monday morning. As I was leaving the gym on Monday morning, I received a call from a South African Police Services inspector. He was following up on my case that had been opened the previous Wednesday. This was the last thing that I expected, as I'd assumed it would take months before they devoted any effort to such a menial crime as malicious damage to property. He informed me that I had not provided all Debbie's contact details, as they did not have her work address. I didn't know it, as she'd started a new job recently with a couple who were friends of hers. I remembered I might have the address on an email she'd sent, so I said I'd bring it in as I was on my way to the Randburg Magistrates' Courts. The inspector said he'd phoned Debbie to discuss what had happened, and she promptly put the phone down on him. I smiled and told him that that sounded like the Debbie I knew. I'd had the photographs of the trashed gate developed, so I gave them to the inspector. He said they'd be following it up in due course, and I'd made my way back to the courts. The waiting game continued, with queues of people all seeking restraining orders, or as they now call them, protection orders. It was pitiful seeing the mothers with small children, some bruised, others just tearful. What was interesting were the number of males, like me, seeking protection from the courts. Whatever happened to the caveman? At about 12:20, I received a call from Debbie, which I ignored, but she kept on calling, and I kept on ignoring. Eventually, her mother called. So I answered. She told me that the police were in the process of arresting Debbie. I couldn't believe it. I was shocked. Why would they do this? Debbie called again and screamed at me, "You bastard! You're having me arrested! They've just put me back into the back of a police van and they're taking me away!" I was stunned. I hadn't expected this, nor did I want it. I'd merely charged her with malicious damage to property to make it easier to get a restraining order. I hadn't figured that the police would be there so quickly. I never thought they'd arrest her for this. But, as it turns out, the police were quite miffed that they'd been sworn at and told to get lost, so I decided to pay her a visit. Debbie didn't respond well to their visit and had apparently put up a performance, so they arrested her to continue their investigation in the police cells. Her mother called me again and begged me to withdraw my case against her. I readily agreed. Her mother left work to meet me at the Randburg police station. By now, Debbie was already in the cells. I spoke to the senior officer and explained what had happened and that I would like to withdraw the case. He wasn't happy with this. He said that if he'd done what Debbie had done, I wouldn't be withdrawing my case against him. I explained that she was the mother of two young children, that I felt that the humiliation she had experienced, being arrested at work, dumped into the back of a police van and put in a police cell, was more than sufficient punishment for her. He tried to talk me out of it, but I insisted. So he directed me to the investigating officer, and I told him that I was withdrawing the case. The investigating officer wasn't happy either. I had to write an affidavit and outline why I was withdrawing the case. While doing this, I spoke to the female officer who had been present when Debbie was arrested and asked her what had happened. She merely said that it hadn't gone well, that Debbie was extremely difficult and it hadn't been pleasant. I completed my affidavit and asked when Debbie should be released. They said she had to get an attorney and post R1,000 as bail. I went outside and told Pat what she needed to do to get her daughter out of jail, and then went back to the magistrate's courts. Getting my protection order was now very urgent, as I feared that Debbie might go on the warpath once she was released. After some time, I finally managed to speak to a magistrate and explained what had happened. I showed her the photographs and expressed my concern about what Debbie might do next. Even though the courts had now officially closed for the day, she granted me an interim protection order, but explained it was not valid until such time that it had been officially served on Debbie. Only the sheriff of the court or a police officer could do this. I left the courts and went to the sheriff's offices, but they had closed for the day. So now I had my order, but it wasn't valid. The order prohibited her from contacting Brett, Shana, or myself in person, telephonically, by SMS, or by email. If she did so, I had in my position a permanent warrant of arrest, which I only needed to hand to a police officer, and she'd be arrested immediately. This was serious stuff, but I had my doubts whether Debbie would see it that way. In fact, I could bet money on it that she'd totally ignore it. Sometimes, when she was in that frame of mind, she was a law unto herself. In between my activities to obtain the protection order, I had received several calls from Eliza and Pat saying that Debbie was still in custody and they hadn't yet managed to get an attorney appointed. Eventually they did, but as things turned out, the police were obviously still miffed by Debbie's treatment of and behaviour to them, that they created all sorts of delays. By 2200, with bail not forthcoming, Debbie was to spend the night in jail. I was very upset about this, as I didn't think she deserved this, but then again, I wasn't present when she abused the police and put the phone down on them, nor did I witness her behavior, which ultimately resulted in her arrest and detention. The court hearing was set for 9 o'clock the next morning, so I went to the sheriff's offices very early that morning. I explained that she would be in court by 9 o'clock and asked them to serve the notice on her at that time. They managed to do this, so I had my protection. But as soon as it was valid, she phoned me. The case had been officially withdrawn, the magistrate had released her, and she was on her way home with her mother. She screamed and performed and cursed me, telling me how I'd destroyed her. I decided not to try and talk to her, so simply said goodbye and ended the call. short while later, I received a call from her mom to apologize for the phone call, saying it wouldn't happen again. Pat said that Debbie had completely lost it and had tried to jump out of the moving car, but that she'd managed to hold her back, even though she was driving at the time. I reminded Pat that I had experienced this several times before, and in fact so had Debbie's kids. I knew this would not be the last of it, and asked Pat to do her best to explain to Debbie the seriousness of the protection order and the consequences if she breached it. I also mentioned that I was concerned that Debbie would attend the Robbie Williams concert and cause trouble, and that I'd have to have her arrested, which nobody wanted. I offered to buy her ticket back from her and tear it up, but Pat said that as far as she was aware, Debbie had swapped the ticket or given it to someone else, so she wouldn't be near us. She mentioned that Debbie was going to see another psychologist later that afternoon, which was somewhat of a surprise to me, as Eliza really understood Debbie and could help her. Pat, however, was confident that Debbie would not contact me again. I knew then that Pat just did not understand her daughter. It only took her a couple of hours before she contacted me again. At about that time, she said she would have finished her appointment with her new psychologist. I received another abusive SMS from her. I ignored it, but forwarded it to her mother, which was how I dealt with all the subsequent SMSs from her. This irritated Debbie, so she sent me an SMS telling me to grow up and leave her mother out of it. I ignored her. The next evening, while I was out, she arrived at my gate and dumped a whole lot of different items all over my driveway, mostly gifts I'd bought her, such as clothing and jewelry, but amusingly enough, she kept the most expensive gifts. She returned photographs and cards as well. I guess it was her way of trying to sever all links with me, or maybe it was just her way of showing total defiance of the court order, as she left her copy in the driveway as well. Brett called me to tell me of this, and that he'd picked up all the items and put them in a large black refuse bag. Over the next few days, she didn't let up. Often the SMSs contained invitations to have her arrested for being in contact with me, because, as she said, that is who you are. I ignored her and prayed that she would come to her senses. On the day of the Robbie Williams concert, she sent me an SMS to ask if I wanted to buy her ticket, the ticket that she supposedly swapped with someone else, the same ticket I had offered to buy back from her mother and tear up. As always, I ignored the SMS. We attended the concert, and during the performance, I received two SMSs from her, the first just before 9 o'clock, in which she said, "Arrest me, do what you please. I was always right about you, heartless and a liar." I ignored it. About an hour later, the next SMS arrived, in which she said, "Not to worry, I'm here with my ex-lover, Arno." Although we were standing on the field, among thousands of other people, I couldn't help but look around to see if she was about to attack us. The last thing I wanted or needed was an humiliating public confrontation. Fortunately, nothing happened. The next SMS arrived a few days later, but that was only to request the settlement amount for her car, which had been financed in my name, as a favour to her, as she could not obtain credit in her name. I got the information and emailed the details directly to her mother. About 10 days later, she sent another SMS saying that it was easy for me to forget her and that I did not know the meaning of love. The next one I received was late in May, but I recognized it as a message she'd sent weeks before, so I guess she'd been scrolling through her messages and decided to send it again. It was the last one. I know that Debbie really loved me. She loved me as much and as intensely as anyone ever had, if not more. She knew what her problems were. She never denied them. She tried many times to fix them, but never quite got there. I don't believe her motives were anything other than loving me and wanting to have a happy long-term relationship with me. Yes, there was the age gap, yes. There was the difference in experience and maturity. Yes, there was the so-called security that I represented to a single mother with two young kids, but that wasn't the reason she wanted to be with me. With the benefit of hindsight, I would say she loved me unconditionally, but she never loved herself unconditionally. Did I love her unconditionally? Yes, I really believe so. But we'd been together for just over 3 years, excluding the 4 months break we had when I was with Gloria. And the dramas never stopped. They were too frequent. We would take 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 2 steps forward, 2 steps back. In my mind, we weren't able to make sufficient progress together. I was too strong, too dominant, too stubborn, too gentle, too generous, too accommodating. But having said this, I've always had a very strong love for her. Did she learn the lesson of rejection with me in her life? No. Were the consequences worse for her each time she failed to learn it? Most definitely. Hopefully she would come to terms with everything and learn her lesson. I really hoped so. Not only for her sake, but for the sake of her 2 boys.